And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hello and welcome to Action Packed, the travel podcast. I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Together we've spent half a lifetime travelling to just about every corner of the world, making a living as travel writers out of what we like doing best.
And that's skiing, biking, beaches, hiking and a whole lot more.
Each week, Action Packed gives us the opportunity to share with you on the show some of these great experiences and the amazing people we meet along the way. Right now, real travel is limited to a daily walk around our local park, but the world will one day return to normal.
Meanwhile, dreams are risk-free and they're always available. You can find out more about us on our website, actionpacktravel.com. We'll regularly be posting links and show notes and loads of other useful stuff. If you like what you hear, please click on the subscribe button and listen to more episodes.
So this week we're on safari in Africa with Aardvark Safaris, talking to Alice Gully, whose encyclopedic 22-year-old knowledge of almost every luxury camp on the continent is invaluable to anyone wanting to see wild animals in their natural habitat. If you don't know how to spell it, let alone know what an aardvark is, details of the company are all on our show notes. So, Alice, welcome on the show. As your website tells us, you've ridden, driven, punted and drifted. You've floated and hiked, scrambled and flitted all over this wonderful continent in search of the best places, the best adventures and the best people. So now, for you personally, where are the big three, the most exciting and rewarding safaris of all?
It's really hard to whittle it down. I think you want to be as wild as possible. You don't want to go on safari to see lots of other people. So somewhere like Zambia is, and there's a particular place, particular camp in Zambia that I love because you really are away from everybody. It's called Lui and it's in the middle of South Lurango National Park, probably one of the camps that is the furthest into the park. And it's very, it's only open for a short time in the year because of the rains and they have black cotton soil there. So it can't open up for during the rainy season. So it's just open from May to October. And that's one place which I love. A riding safari probably would be the other type of safari. Possibly because you can go off road, you can get away from people, but you also are riding part of the food chain, if you like. So the horses are very aware of where you are, what tracks you're crossing, any noises, any smells, and it adds another dimension to your safari, without a doubt. And probably my third choice of safari is to take my children with me. They ask the best questions. They open up opportunities with guides and people that we meet. We've been welcomed into homes that we would never have been welcomed into without them. So I think they're not specifically countries as such, but children definitely do a lot for a safari holiday. Horses are quite exciting and Zambia offers that remoteness that I enjoy.
Now, while Felice has been on loads of safaris, I have to confess that I've never been on a single one. In the course of my career as a newspaper correspondent, I spent quite a lot of time in the bush with various armies and armed factions in different African countries. But when it comes to safaris, I'm a complete beginner. So I need to know exactly what happens.
I think it's quite hard to give you an exact timetable, if you like, because what we do with our company is tailor each and every holiday. So depending on what sort of person you are, what sort of experience you want, we would then match you to a slightly different safari to somebody else. So normally a safari holiday would have to tick your boxes first. And that might be to do with where you go, whether you're walking or whether you're riding or whether you're in a jeep safari. And if you, most people on their first safari want to see as much wildlife as possible. So we would probably pick slightly different parks and slightly different areas. Then once somebody's been once or twice, they get to know what they want to see and what sort of style they enjoy, and we can get a little bit more fine-tuning. So on a first-time safari, we'd probably suggest somewhere where you could definitely go and see the term, the big five, that I don't like because it's associated to the old hunting days, but the bigger animals, the a sort of checklist, if you like, and hopefully get the best time of year so you don't have a problem with insects or weather. And then and if you wanted to, if you're a golfer or if you're a walker, we'd incorporate a little bit of that so that people enjoy the activities that they do. And then go from there. And generally they start early in the morning, so that your activities are generally aimed around the activities of the animals. So if it's a hot time of year, they start earlier. There's a longer lunch break, a siesta break, because the animals don't do much in the heat of the day. And then you would go out again in the afternoon, and in the hotter times of year you go out later, in the cooler times of year you go out earlier. So there are, generally speaking, safaris are split into two activities a day. It's not always about driving, it can be about different activities. And then you have a long siesta in the middle of the day, amazing food, very comfortable accommodation normally, and very jolly evenings as well.
What sort of accommodation can people stay in? Is it hotels or tents or something else?
Again, it would depend on what people want, which isn't very helpful as an answer, but it varies from a camp bed and a roll mat outside with no tents at all. And in certain areas, you don't need mosquito nets if you go at the right time of the year, to dome tents where you're very mobile and you move your camp every couple of days with a team of guys. Or so there'll be tented camps, which would be rooms under canvas, which are quite big rooms, ensuite bathrooms, flushing loos. And then lodges would be a permanent structure, a permanent home normally, with stone cottages and thatched roofs, that sort of idea, but much more, you're not open to the elements in any aspect. And then there are a few hotels in safari areas. We tend not to use them because they can take up to sort of 200 people in one place. They use minibuses, which can be quite an impersonal way of going on a game drive. But you can go to five-star hotels in the middle of the Masai Mara. It's possible, with all the extra more cons that that brings.
Do safaris differ from one African country to another?
Yes, they do. There's definitely something like Namibia, which is desert adapted, would have a very different setup to somewhere like the Masai Mara in Kenya, where the wildlife is different, the way of going from A to B is different. So you know, each country has got a different rainy season, a different perks. So Zambia would be good for leopards, for example. South Africa is very good for families because so much of it's malaria free. Kenya's got a very strong tie with the UK, and a lot of people enjoy going back to Kenya. Tanzania is a bit wilder. Malawi doesn't have many full national parks with teeming with wildlife like you would see in the Kruger or the Masai Mara, but it's much more rewarding in terms of local people, the conservation work they're doing, getting back to really understanding how the country works and the people in the country. So yeah, they all vary slightly.
What about the food? Do you get to eat what you see?
That used to be the case. When I lived in Zimbabwe, we used to have, we tried to do a game meat meal once during someone's stay. And I think you will probably find certain countries you can't do it. They don't allow it. And some countries you will eat ostrich like you can over here, I guess, and certain types of venison. It's less popular than it used to be. Not South Africa, they definitely have, you can definitely find kudu on the menu and that kind of thing, but less so in Kenya. But the food, we always get comments on how good the food is, and people can't believe, even on the very simplest of mobile safaris. And my children were baking bread in the ground with a Samburu's the last time we went to Kenya. They really can produce these incredible fresh meals, very Western meals, really, from almost nothing, from a tiny little camp stove or a bread oven. And some people will give you a traditional evening, sort of traditional African food one evening and mix it up a bit, but it tends to be Western food that people will be familiar with, and that it reliably people tell us how incredible the food is. And in fact, probably one of the complaints we get, I guess, would be the food and the fact that there's so much of it and it's so delicious. And I think some people have a bit of a conscience about that when they're out in Africa and they're rejecting puddings and cakes when there is a feeling that there's so much, a bit of waste, I guess.
How do safaris help the local communities? Do many locals work with companies like yours?
Yes, lots and lots. We actually, this is quite a big focus for us at the moment with the coronavirus. What we do as a company, we go out to Africa and we check out new camps. And part of the criteria is that we're not using international chain hotels. We are using locally run and operated camps and lodges throughout each country. Not in every case, but in the majority of cases. And then each one of those small camps, which we tend to use over, or lodges, over the big hotels, if you go on a ratio of 1 to 10 and they had 40 members of staff, each member of staff would probably support about 10 people in that immediate community. So it's very important to have this engagement. If they've got 3 children, they have to pay for education in most African countries. That supports the local school. You'll find grandparents are supported by the lodge, parents, the local football team, the local medical clinic. The knock-on effects are huge for each and every camp, even in these tiny, tiny camps, which only have 6 rooms. There's a huge local involvement. And local guides are normally the best guides. The guys who've grown up in the local area, or certainly the country, they know the specifics about that country in so much detail. And sometimes in the Maasai Mara, you're dealing with Maasai guys who've grown up in the next door village. And they can tell you where they first found a snake, when they first met an elephant on foot. It's literally their back garden. So, yes, it's very important to engage locally.
Can you take children on a safari?
So we've been doing this for 22 years. And a lot of us, I think about half of our sales team have got children. And we've all travelled with our children. So we put a lot of effort and checklist ticking about which camp is suitable for children and which ones are not only suitable for children but look after them properly so that parents also have a break, because everyone knows if your kids are happy on holiday, you have a much better holiday. Certain countries have certain restrictions on game drives or if children can join you at meal times, that kind of thing. So I wouldn't go too young, and also for them to remember it and to get the most out of it, you really want them going when they can get involved in all the activities and not be needing lunchtime naps and that sort of thing. So I would say 8 and upwards is perfect, but there are certainly good safaris that we can do for children who are 5 and 6, and South Africa or Kenya tends to fit that slightly better than the other countries.
And what are the biggest dangers? Are some animals more dangerous than others when you're on safari?
I think dangerous is difficult to answer. That animals are normally dangerous when they're threatened or in an unusual situation. So if anybody has not listened to their guide and has approached too close or has left their tent at night when they've heard something, then an animal could be dangerous because they don't know what's going on. We haven't ever had a problem with an animal on safari because people are with very qualified guides and they do listen to what they're being told. Humans are probably a danger to themselves. Hippos are probably the most dangerous animals in Africa in terms of what they can do. And obviously every animal, even a bushbuck, I've seen a bushbuck caught in a fence and sadly had to be put down because they couldn't get it out and it was so threatening with its horns. So even a lovely bushbuck that looks like Bambi, when it's cornered and people are trying to help it, it can be very dangerous. So I think it's a difficult one to answer. Normally accidents happen when people have done something foolish. And most animals have a way of warning you, like an elephant definitely has a way of warning people to back off. And again, if you canoed through a pod of hippos, you'd probably be asking for trouble. If you did anything without a guide and not knowing what you were doing, you'd probably be asking for trouble as well. But we haven't, touch wood, had any of them from dangerous animals.
What about elephants? You mentioned there. Can elephants be dangerous?
Yes, probably the ones that I'm the most worried about. Yes, definitely. And there have been incidences over the time where they can be incredibly protective. So they again, will do anything to protect their young and their family connections, and that can quite often get themselves into trouble, sadly. They are also partial to fruit and veg, so they can sometimes be on a bit of a mission to go lodge, kitchen, or garden, and destroy fences or property in the meantime. But I have been charged by an elephant in Tanzania, and it is terrifying. And although she was protecting her baby, and she did put a tusk into the vehicle, but she, and I didn't think I was worried about them until a year or so later when I was next out there, and an elephant got too close to the car, and I passed out, sadly. And so it's become a sort of a bit of a phobia in the true sense of the word, that I can't actually control myself properly. So I do have to keep a distance with elephants. But they are, yeah, they can be. They're very intimidating, obviously, and very protective.
You mentioned to me before that you once fell asleep and found an elephant was right next to you.
Yeah, so that was a while, so this is a long time, this is 22, 23 years ago, before that situation in Tanzania. And I was working in Lake Kariba on an island called Chetty Island, which is on the Zambian side of Lake Kariba. And there were two of us walking one day. We were looking for a group of family of seven elephants who lived on the island, and was recording markings. And we stopped, we hadn't found the elephants, we stopped and we rested against two trees sort of facing each other. I was sort of woken up with the guide telling me to don't move a muscle and not to go anywhere. And I looked down, and this trunk was coming sort of from behind the tree and was sniffing all the way along my legs and up my body, trying to suss out what it was, all the way around my head and back down again. And then very quietly, no one, well, neither of us moved, it carried on and just left us alone. And the guy was saying, because we were in its space, he came into our space, and just checked us out, didn't think we were a threat, and just carried on walking. But had that happened after we'd been charged, I might not have been quite so relaxed.
What about being chased by buffaloes? I think you said you were once chased by buffaloes.
In terms of a scary experience, most things that have happened in Africa, you're normally... and even when we chat to clients, they come back with these amazing experiences that aren't scary because they're sort of managed, if you like. And really, the time I did get scared, knowing that I was scared at the time, was when we were pushing the boundaries too far. I lived in Zimbabwe and I was working on a riding safari. We decided we'd try full moon rides as a sort of trial with a couple of the local guys, and we went with another professional guide. And I decided to take a horse called Delancey, who was gelded very late, so still had quite a lot of stallion tendencies, which was my first mistake. We then went down to a waterhole to see if anything was drinking at the time under the full moon. There was a huge herd of buffalo there, and we got into some thorns called waiter little thorns, which have got horrific hooks that go either side that catch you or anything passing. And my horse, we split the herd of buffalo without meaning to, and they suddenly spooked and all charged. My horse set off, but sort of dropped his back legs to get through a bush, and I did stay with him, but I lost my t-shirt. It was ripped off, and my arms were really bleeding. And again, the buffaloes weren't chasing us in particular. They were trying to reunite the herd, but we got stuck in the middle of it. But that was the end of the full moon riding idea.
To go on a safari on a horse, do you have to be a very experienced rider?
No, you don't have to be. There's a number of rides that you can do, and they're very much split between advanced, intermediate and beginner. So my children have ridden in South Africa on a reserve called Ant's Nest, which is this most incredible place for families, but they have got very chilled out ponies. They don't have elephant, they don't have lion, and they've got very habituated, not tame, but habituated rhinos. And you can ride there. My husband's ridden there, actually, and he really is anti-horse. But you can posture around, walk and trot, getting close to sable, zebra, giraffe, and it's very safe. If you want to ride with the migration in Kenya or in the Okavango Delta in Botswana, you have to be a capable rider just for the safety of the group.
What about snakes? During my time in East Africa, I encountered quite a few. And foolish though it may be, I have to confess that I'm not that happy to be around them.
If you wanted to see a snake, you would go during the rains and when it was slightly warmer. to find snakes in the dry season when it's cooler for them is quite difficult. We have very, very few people who come back with snake stories. Occasionally, pythons are seen quite a lot. Unless people go to somewhere like the Kalahari during the rains, when you're definitely increasing your chances of seeing them. So, no, they're not common. Normally, they hear you long before you see them, so they scuttle off. Most of them don't hang around. I don't know how common or how rare they are. I'd say something like 20 to 30% of people would see a snake on a safari, but it's very unusual. We had one instance when I was working in Zimbabwe where we had a snake, a spitting cobra in the kitchen, and the chef got quite upset about it because in Ndebele, there's a link with witch doctors that it's related to adultery, and it's a sort of punishment for adultery. And I wasn't aware of this, and he then went home and found another spitting cobra under his bed, which he took as a second warning about adultery, somebody in his family or his wife. And then I think the cobra ended up biting him, or he was bitten through a plimsoll, but it caught the rubber of his plimsoll. And at that point, he said he wasn't coming to work until he established what was going on.
Sounds like he definitely needed to sort out his marriage at this stage.
Third warning.
You mentioned that some lodges are now using hides for better photo opportunities.
Time goes on looking for fresh ideas, keeping people engaged, offering something new. Everyone always wants to be able to offer something new. And a big thing in the last 3 to 5 years probably are these photography hides. If anyone wants to try and get a slightly different angle or a closer shot to something like the Carmine Beaters, which are beautiful in Zambia, a number of lodges have now set up hides. One quite clever idea is to get a shipping container and to sink it into the ground next to a waterhole, and so that your eye height, your camera lens, is at eye height to the level of the water. There are some pretty good photos that you can get of elephants with their trunks drinking right next to where you're sitting, and those hides are obviously in place all the time, so the elephants don't know whether they've got people in them or not. There's another one for lion and leopard in the Luangwa Valley as well, so you can just get into these hides, and they're quite a peaceful way of safarying. If you go into a hide over a lunch break or a siesta, and you can just look up every so often if you're reading a book over siesta, and just be in the hide, have everything in front of you so you can take the right photo, but just wait for things to come to you rather than you chasing things around by car. So it's quite a nice way of doing it.
Poaching, rhino in particular, is never far from the headlines. Yeah. Is that a problem?
Yeah, it is a problem. The species is definitely, or a couple of species are definitely in trouble. We do a lot of work with lodges and guides and fundraisers on this. It's an education problem. Sometimes preaching to the West doesn't really help because that's not where the animal is going, although that's where most of the funds are raised. But there are a number of very, very good safari operators and private landowners who are protecting them. Rhino poaching is shocking. And at the moment, a poacher can get in and out of a situation very quickly with a rhino horn, often quicker than anyone else can pick them up. But at the moment, with the corona lockdown and travel bans, I haven't got any data updated, but I know they're worried about subsistence poaching for local guys sustaining their taking food home, basically. But I wondered if there might be a drop in some bigger, more commercial poaching, because it would be harder to get ivory tusks and horn out of the country. But that's not confirmed. I just wondered if the movement of those kind of things would be difficult at the moment. But rhinos are increasing in certain countries. There are definitely some safe havens. They are still at risk. They are definitely still at risk. But it's an education for the Vietnam, China, those areas where some children that we spoke to didn't even know that rhino horn came from an animal. They thought it was a sort of substance that you could dig out of the ground. It's just there's so little education on the ground. And that's where it's really got to change. And whether there's enough time to do that is another question.
How about the local staff at the moment? Presumably they don't have any work.
Yeah, we've spoken to a number of lodges about this, and yes, a lot of them have been reduced hours. So some of them have laid off some staff. Others have taken them to sort of 30% pay for the next couple of months for as long as they can, so that they're engaged in tourism and employed in tourism. Some people have, one guy I spoke to in Botswana, he very rightly pointed out that if he lays his staff off, he can expect a drop in wildlife in the immediate area around his camp, because the camp, the area, if those guys need food, the first place they're going to go to for a snare is on their doorstep, which they know, which will be his camp. So he's wanting to keep people engaged as much as he can. Some other camps are changing the roles of the staff. So they've been taken off housekeeping and put onto anti-poaching. So they join anti-poaching patrols. And other guides and camps have set up virtual game drives. And we've been encouraging everyone to log in and watch some of these game drives, because having those guides out and about filming, it means that poachers can hear vehicles. They're still going out. They're still, and they know they've got a following behind them. And that's encouraging these guys as well to stay engaged in tourism.
How do you see a virtual game drive? Is it on your website or?
Facebook's got most of them. But we can definitely, we've got a few details on our Instagram and Facebook page, but a lot of the safari lodges as well. We've been sharing quite a few of them. But a lot of the safari lodges have also been posting them on a daily basis. So there are a lot out there, and they're normally an hour or two long. But you can watch in the corner of your screen if you want. You can go on a virtual safari.
What about mosquitoes and other insects?
Yeah, there definitely are. I'm a sort of entomologist dream in Africa. But they, again, tend to be a wet season problem. Obviously, not all of Africa is malarial. Some bits are malaria-free or low-risk malaria. Yeah, as soon as the rains come, there is literally an outburst of insects. And the other place which we went to in the dry season, but it did actually when we were there, was Brazzaville, Congo. And my husband, who's been on lots of safaris, said that trip there were just too many insects for him. And I do warn people now, if they go to see the lowland gorillas in Congo, they have to be prepared for crunchy bathrooms, because there's a lot of insects there.
Tell me about safari ants. They can be pretty dangerous, can't they? I think your husband once had a bad experience with them. What happened?
So we were walking in the Kafue National Park near a camp called Basanga. And Jim suddenly started really slapping himself all the way down his legs. And the guide said, oh, you're being bitten by a load of ants at the same time. So we had to quickly pull his pants down and his shorts down and get all these ants off his legs. But they've got these incredibly strong jaws that go through the skin. So when you're pulling these ants off, you're also pulling them out of his skin. And their jaws are so strong that the Maasai use them as sutures sometimes to heal cuts. So they have their uses as well. But when you're bitten by a few of them at the same time, it is incredibly painful. As Jim found out on walking safari, if you stand still for too long in their path, they will go up your legs. Jim's first night in Africa, which was actually on the same trip as the safari ant story, but I said to him, you'll definitely hear things through the night. There'll be bush babies on top of the tent, but just don't worry about it. It won't be anything. And he woke up early and said, there is a pride of lions outside our room, and they've been making a huge noise all night. And I was pretty patronising and told him it was probably just a bush baby, and of course it wasn't lions. It's so unusual to have them this close. Anyway, we got ready to go to breakfast, and sure enough, there were a pride of lions about 30 metres away eating what they killed through the night just outside our room. And so we couldn't go for breakfast and had to wait to be saved. But he was quite right. There had been a pride of lions causing a lot of chaos. And it was right outside our room. So that was his first night on safari.
What's a typical guest like?
We have a huge variety of people wanting quite a variety. Although a safari sounds like a one type of holiday, there is an enormous diversity. So I would say our typical guest is somebody who wants to engage with their local environment, and that can come in any form. But if you want to lie flat and get a suntan and not know where you are, Africa's probably not for you. But the majority of the people, you learn a lot on safari. It's a very interesting holiday. Because we only sell Africa and the Indian Ocean, we also have a very educated database, have a very loyal client following. We haven't had many cancellations. Most people still want to travel. And so most people, probably something like 90% of them during this particular incident, have postponed their travel till next year. In that way that we haven't had many people wanting to just pull out, they understand, they've gone through Ebola with us in 2008, they understand that things come back and they still want to go. So yeah, we are fortunate that we've got an understanding.
So what should someone pack to go on safari? I mean, you need obviously some special clothes, and what kind of footwear?
So we do have a very snappy interactive online packing list, which we brought out last year, which we because again, depending on whether you're going during the rains, depending on whether you're going to Namibia, Madagascar, all these countries have slightly different requirements. But generally speaking, you want to have muted colours, nothing bright that's going to stand out, especially if you're walking or getting out of a vehicle. You want to not blend in safari colours, but just no bright blues or pinks or bright whites, and sturdy footwear. Recommend that you wear closed shoes on safari. The other thing I'd say as well is that people tend to go during the dry season for obvious reasons, but that is also Africa's winter normally. And the winter can get a lot cooler than people think. So we always tell people, just to warn them, especially June, July in Southern Africa. So we always encourage people to take hats, gloves and a fleece for those early mornings. It's often cooler than you think. And there are hot water bottles in your bed and that kind of thing at night.
Are there particular specialist types of safari? What if people want to see leopards, for example?
Yeah, we do get requests from people who want to see a specific species on safari. There are ways of maximising their chances. I'd say Mother Nature always has the final word, so it's very hard to give any guarantees. If people want to see leopards, we'd normally, I mean, there's a number of places you can go, but the South Luangwa in Zambia is very good. And there is a camp in the South Luangwa who have had, I think, a 3-year success rate of leopard sightings just from their location and the food source that surrounds the camp. And we were there, and Jim, again, my husband, was sitting in the bath. They've got an outside bathroom on the banks of the river, and one walked past the bath.
Do you think the safaris will survive successfully when travel fully returns in the post-viral world that hopefully we'll have one day? Clearly, we're going to have a deep recession. And of course, safaris are an expensive type of holiday.
I think they will recover when the bounce back happens because of the nature of a safari, especially the safaris that we do. The social distancing is almost a norm. You're not hanging out with lots of people. I mean, I know you've got to fly out there on an aeroplane, but once you get there, you are away from cities, away from big hotels. So I think the safari industry will recover, but the recession will affect everybody. We didn't do too bad in the last recession. This sort of level of safari seems to cope quite well, but I don't know. We're just going to have to do what we can and help people as much as we can when we get out the other side and the travel bans are lifted. But I think the safari industry will survive, if on a little skinnier version.
Alice Gully, thank you very much for appearing on the show. We wish you the very best of luck in the future with Aardvark Safaris. By the way, that's AARD, and Google should do the rest for you.
Peter and Felice, thank you for having me on the show.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.